Yo, brother, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing excellent, man. Doing good. Just blessed and highly favored, and just another day to do what I do, you know?
Right. Hey, brother, thank you so much for thank you so much for being on the show, man. I'm getting all
tight. I appreciate it.
And stuff like that. So check it out. So for all of the guests of Hip-Hopalypse, man, I got a very, very, very special dynamic, interesting guest on the show. And I'm going to tell you why it's interesting in a moment. So this man here, singer, rapper, dancer, producer, he's like a prince. He plays multiple instruments. He's been in the presence of the likes of legends such as George Clinton. Y'all know who George Clinton is. I shouldn't have to explain who George Clinton is. This guy put out an album called The Planet 12 Movement. He's been on various shows. I mean, the list goes on. We're talking about A&E, Lifetime, MTV. Just the list just goes on and on. And to be quite honest with you, when you're dealing with someone of a stature of this, is really difficult to prepare for interviews like this, because it's kind of like jumping in a pool. You just don't know what end to jump in on. But without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I have a gentleman from New York, Brooklyn, that is.
It's coming up
from my man, Law. Law, what's up, baby boy? How you doing, man?
What's going on, man? Thank you. That was a hell of an intro. I dug that, man. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, brother, man. Thank you so much for the compliment. I really appreciate it. You know, so I was doing research, and I have heard of you, and I heard your music and sound before. So was really strange. This is the third time that I'm saying this in 2 days out of all of the interviews that I've been doing. It's really unfair to say that you're an up-and-coming artist, because you have a hell of an impressive resume, my man.
Thank you.
I just don't know where to start, because it's just so much. And so what I'm going to do, without further ado, brother, I'm going to just open it up for you just to give us it's so much, so don't take all of the time, brother, that I got.
No, I wasn't trying. I'm not trying to. Everybody always be thinking I'll be going to take the time, but you're right, though, and respectfully and humbly speaking, like, just because it's a lot to digest, so there's a lot of summarization that happens. So I'm cool with it.
So give us a little bit about your background, my man.
Well, first and foremost, you know, coming from a pretty famous musical family, I was born into this, and it wasn't forced on me. So let's start with that on the viewpoint. My legendary grandfather being Sam Bluesman Taylor, my legendary uncle, gospel legend Reverend Charles Taylor. My mother, first place Apollo Theater winner. My uncle Bobby Real Deal Taylor, 13 time Apollo winner. And of course, my other famous cousin, Cheryl Pepsi Riley, who many may know if you know R&B and soul music.
We was just talking about Pepsi Riley. My girlfriend and I, we were just talking about Pepsi Riley a couple of days ago, my man.
Yeah, so see how interesting it is? Because, you know, in the environment of all of that, I was just born into music. And, you know, that's, you know, if I wasn't doing music, I'd be boxing or playing football, because music, sports, and education were the main three things in our household. Some of us did all three. I actually was a former school teacher for 13 years. So it's like that, that whole environment of being, you know, God used music to save my life. So just coming into that, you know, I made my way through the ranks, performing with my family, and eventually I spoke a lot of things into existence. Like, I told my mother at 12 I was going to become a P-Funk member, and right after college it happened, and my whole world opened up. So I was used to being around, you know, a lot of famous artists and celebrities and of the golden years. And then, of course, when hip-hop came into the picture, you know, being that I was in the streets at that time in terms of popularity and rapping and dancing, just always, you know, always being involved in anything musical. So, you know, all the talent shows, I would either be one of the main winners or the actual winner. So it just kind of led into my destiny. So by the time I created Planet 12, I already knew that. After I saw Prince and New Edition and of course, you know, the Jacksons and that whole situation, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. So That's the first half of it in terms of before I started doing all this work with all these amazing people who I grew up idolizing. So,
right, right. And so so what we'll do is we'll touch on the Planet 12 movement in a little bit coming up here. But so let's go back a little bit more to the roots a little bit. And so you started this adventure working with P-Funk. What was that experience like?
Well, I mean, you know, the crazy part is that, you know, again, I told my mom at 12 years old, because at that point, you know, my musical world, I mean, George Clinton is the reason why Planet 12 was even created, because if you look at the album cover of the Planet 12 Syndrome, my first album, right, and then you look at the Mothership Connection album, it ain't hard to tell where I got the concept from. And the whole thing was that, because at that particular time in my life, my musical worlds were colliding. Gotta remember, I'm an 80s baby. So the great thing about being an 80s baby and a 90s kid is that we were in the middle of all this stuff, you know, because you gotta remember, we had the music from our parents of yesteryear. So there's, you know, there's the doo-wop, there's the 70s soul groups like Blue Magic, Dramatics, you know, that whole thing. Then you had the super raw funk of the Ohio Players, the Commodore. Like, so we had that. And then for more deeper measure, you know, progressive rock, you know, Genesis, Yes, and, you know, my Uncle Tony, my legendary Uncle Tony T-Funk also was a serious jazz fusion head. So I had the Mahavishnu Orchestra. I had all that stuff surrounding me.
So was that the motivation for you learning and being able to play all of the musical instruments that you play? Is that all just pick up and learn as you go, or is that formal training for all of those instruments that you know how to play?
All pick up and go. I mean, of course, I've always said that, for, you know, because I'm self-taught pretty much on everything, but I've always said that even in being self-taught, when you get around, as we say, the cats, the OGs, you pick up things. So that's the thing about me. And of course, because I had a family full of them, even though I was self-teaching myself, anytime I got, like, my grandfather was always on the road. So anytime that he would come off the road, you know, he was what you call a real traveling man. He's a serious, you know, him and Albert King, Albert Collins, they're all friends. So basically, anytime he would come off the road and come in New York, you got to see my mother. My mother's this grown woman, but as soon as her father came into town, they became little girls all over again. And the thing was that the time that he would spend with me in that pocket of time when he would be there, he was like, I heard you've been getting good on guitar. So of course, I would be showing him what I already learned on my head. He's like, you're pretty good. And then all of a sudden he'd be like, well, let me show you this right here. You know, use the two strings to up one. If you want to play that Johnny Be Good, you got to use the two strings. So little stuff like that I would get from him. Because remember, he wasn't, at that time before I joined him around 11 to 12. But in that pocket of 7 to 8 years old, it was always, here he is. Now I don't know where he's going to go now. But then it'd be like a year later. And then my mother started playing with other bands in New York. So all of her friends, you know, Crown Heights Affair, those are all my uncles, Crown Heights Affair, Brass Destruction. I was around all of those
construction
guys. Randy Miller's my godfather. So that, like, all these guys I was around, I picked up all this stuff. So when these guys, and this is when they were like kind of, I hate saying past the prime, because I believe you're still doing what you're doing. You're never past your prime. But this was the prime years when, at this particular point, they had achieved the amount of success that they were going to as the sound was changing. So a lot of the members of Brass Destruction and Crown Heights Affair, these guys, and Sky as well, like, these guys served as like my uncle. So, like, you know,
call me Sky. I remember that.
Of course.
Call me.
Yeah.
You know what a trip is? And this may sound like a crazy question, but keep in mind, this is coming from a place and coming from a guy who's out here in California. And so, you know, when you think of like all of these groups, and when you think of someone that's being musically talented, being able to play all of these instruments, quite naturally, we had California, you know, we had the Tower Powers, and then you had the Ohio
Players. Oh, Bay Area, hell yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you had the Tower Powers, you had all of the bands out here, then you had Ohio Players. Then you had that Minneapolis sound, the Princess, the Time.
Of course.
Everybody was playing instruments. But New York is the Mecca of hip hop. You really don't think of bands coming out of New York. And so what was really intriguing about you is, aside from you being able to play instruments, you're also a lyricist as well. How how were you able to balance that? How were you able to become so lyrical as well as play instruments? Because most people that I know, they're one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
With you, you're multi-talented. But with you, you're multi-talented quite naturally. And so what was more of an influence of you? Now, I know the easy answer is to say, well, I just love music. But which was more of an influence for you? Was it one of those things that you was a hip hop head that just happened to go into learning how to play instruments? Or were you instruments and say, well, geez, you know, I like this rap thing. Let me see what I can do with this.
Wow, great question. As I say very often in most interviews that I've done, and then even just in general conversations that I have with people who are fans of mine or becoming fans of mine, I'm definitely, I tell people all the time, I'm a singer first. You know, growing up in, you know, my roots are gospel, funk, R&B, and rock and roll. And because of my legendary grandfather, he had his foot in all three things. Because mind you, all of his friends were the doo-wop guys. You know, his friends were the Olympics, right. The posters, Yakety Yak, like those are all his friends. Like these guys, these are guys that would be at the house. So he had that, then he had the early rock and roll thing because him being the original guitarist of Joy D and the Starlighters. And he gave Jimi Hendrix his job when he left to go work for the Beach Boys. So a lot of that, having a family full of that. Now mind you, I'm 6 years old at the time learning all this stuff. And at seven, I'm trying to get a better understanding of what I'm a part of. So for me, naturally, all of those styles became first. So the transition to hip hop was pretty easy because one of my models that I always say to everybody is that without the funk, there would be no hip hop. Because when Kool Herc and the forefathers like Grand Wizard Theodore, of course, Bambaataa and all the Soul Sonic Force, when all of those guys, all the forefathers of hip hop first started, they were all what? DJs. And when they first started cutting the first great beats are what? Funk music, UFO.
Funk music, yep.
Like those beats are all Afro beats, and if it's not Afro beat, it's funk. So a lot of the James Brown, this is KRS-One said it best in a record called I'm Outta Here. When they were talking about the Paid in Full album and the Criminal Minded album, he said that hip hop pioneers, we didn't ask to be, but right then, hip hop changed drastically. People got tired of using the same old rap sound, so we started sampling beats by James Brown. And that's when the game began to change, because now Marley Marl, DST and Larry Smith and all these guys, even though they were very original, the pre-beats before Run DMC and Houdini started having original beats, it was all like either being replayed, like Melly Mel and them, they basically, you know, and then of course Rapper's Delight, we already know what song they got that from. So it's almost the funk and disco element was so prominent in those early parts. So for me, now here's me. My cousin Showbiz, more so my uncle, you know, he was already hanging with Kumo D and the Treacherous D in the Bronx. Even though he's from Brooklyn, he spent a lot of his time in the Bronx. Every time he would come to the house in Brooklyn, he was just always rapping, and then him and my uncle were b-boys. So I'm looking at these guys, and then as I'm looking at them, I'm looking at some of my friends as well. So for me, it's like, hey, I can do that. And I was always good with words anyway. So, you know, I started just putting little things together. I'm like, well, I can rap and I can sing. And then I had the interesting dilemma, because now the balance of me singing in church with my grandmother's church, and then on the streets, it was more like rap gave me the expressive voice that I didn't have as a singer. Because back then, like you said earlier, you had to be either or. Like either it wasn't, or. At that point, it wasn't cool to be a rapper and a singer. But it's funny because if you listen to Flashmas on the beat, they're singing. But the thing with them is just that it was like, okay, but they're not gonna, like Melly Mel and Scorpio's not gonna get on the mic and croon. You understand what I'm saying? Like he's not gonna get on the mic and serenade you and give you that. So this is where people like, look, here's one of my earliest influences. Brenda K. Starr, she doesn't get enough credit. I'm Brenda Starr, I'm not because Brenda K. Starr, she started out, she's a singer first. Remember who her father is. So the thing is,
I just seen her on Beat Street the other night.
See what I mean? But she was also rapping. But if I saw an interview with her where she talks to the story, she's like, well, I'm from a rap crew, but I was a singer. They don't never credit her. But I said, believe it or not, she predates pretty much, I mean, not counting Tina Marie's rap, because that was more so her trying to capitalize on the hip-hop thing. But Brenda K. Starr was a real rapper that was a real singer too. And then for me, it didn't make sense. This is the two most important elements for me. Actually, three. This is where it all made sense, because I'm rapping, I'm singing, but you gotta remember, Prince, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, those are my first primary heroes. But what was the problem? They were all adults. Even though I looked up to them, I'm trying to be like them. It didn't make sense to me until I saw these three entities that changed my life forever. Mm-hmm. New Edition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they changed Force, everybody's life.
New Edition, Force MDs, and UTFO. Because now I'm looking at Inch for a Scratch. All five members can sing lead. They all could dance, but all these dudes can rap too. Remember, the Force MDs were first called the Force MCs. So when I started learning the history, I'm like, it made sense. And the New Edition made it even more sense because the same thing. They rap, they're doing just like they do what I'm doing in the street. I'm rapping, I'm dancing, I'm singing. But when I saw New Edition, they look like me. These are five nappy-headed boys from the hood. I'm from Brooklyn. So it's like, oh, shoot. They doing what we doing, even though they were way older than me. But it still was like, they look like me. I'm like, that's the level I'm trying to get to. I'm trying to step and sing. And I won my first talent show singing Lost in Love by New Edition. So for me, it made sense. But at the same time, I'm like, but I'm stuck being an MC now. So now it's like, I'm singing, I'm rapping. And then I kept getting pulled. You know, my mother's friend was like, yeah, I love the way he sings, but I can't get with that rap noise. You know, I wasn't. My parents didn't like rap until it became explosive. And then on the other end, my friends are like, yeah, I like that. I like you spit that rhyme. I ain't with the singing too much. But I got to a point where I just said, you know what? F all this. I'm going to do it all. Why not do it all? And that's how I felt. That's what I said, because New Edition already had the blueprint. I'm like, they singing and rapping. I was like, so I can do the same. And they dance and they ass, and they step and they asses. I was already a natural at that. So it was almost like, why can I not just do it all? The only difference is that I, of course, excelled in my instrumentation because of who my family is. So my whole thing of learning theory on my own, I learned a little bit of theory and I took what I learned from that and applied it to what I was already learning on my own. So by the time I turned 11 and 12, I was good enough to play behind my grandfather on the West Coast. So
yeah. And the transition, believe it or not, being involved with playing instruments, and this isn't discrediting the art. I'm just saying the transition makes it that much easier. You know, typically when you know how to play one instrument, you're able to play other instruments. But then, because you are in this whole cocoon of music and influences, it makes it really easy for you to go in and say, hey, listen, I could be lyrical as well. You know, you mentioned some hella groups, Kumo D, Treacherous Tree.
Of course. New Rap Outside. Language. That changed the game. Like, that was one of the, you know, before Smoother Hustler did Broken Language, you know, the Devastating Rock and Bane and Mama, they've been overcooked. Like, that whole style, I mean, as old school as it is, that became the plethora and the environment. And one person I have to mention too as well, because this is the dude that became my favorite rapper, Grandmaster Caz, Cold Crush. Because
Caz.
Mm-hmm. Metal Force, and mind you, because you know, my top five favorite MCs of all time is Kool G Rap, Kane, LL, Rakim, and Redman. So that whole top five right there, these are the guys who became my direct forefathers as my style began to evolve as an MC. Because here's the thing you said about doing rhyme and sing at the same time. The way that I sung was very aggressive because of, you know, the Prince thing, the Michael Jackson New Edition thing. And I said to myself, if I'm going to add an MC to what I'm doing, I need to, you know what I mean? Like, I need to be as aggressive. And at the time when rap was going through a transition, I'm like, okay, I could be smooth when I want to, but I'm rugged too. So it's almost like, okay, who could I look up to? And that Kane came at the perfect time. Kool G Rap came at the perfect time. And especially LL, because even Kane said LL was an influence on him. So because when Rock the Bells came out and I Can't Live on My Radio and I'm Bad, it was like, okay, these dudes are selling their image, because, you know, Kane had the, you know, brown skin thing. So that was good for me because, you know, we all the same sort of, you know, complexion or whatever. But it also gave me the incentive that I could still cater to the ladies because the fellas are easy. As long as I'm nice in the mic, I ain't got to never about no dude saying, oh, he's wet. Now, mind you, they say I'm wet. That's because they probably just have a preference of what they like, but not because I couldn't get on the mic and spit something or do that. And I won every rap battle I ever got into. So for me, it was almost like I had to balance. And at the same time, my weekends were basically that. On Fridays, I'm doing shows with my mother at the Parks Department. And by Saturday, I'm performing with my uncles and my grandfather. And then Sunday, at United Missionary Baptist Church in East New York, I'm singing in my grandmother's choir, me and my sister. So I had the balance of all of that before I turned 13. So when I finally understood it, I just said, you know what? This is the direction we're moving in. So that's how Planet 12 was created, because there's 12 notes of music. And people always said that Law can go from Led Zeppelin to Public Enemy. And, you know, he's on his own planet musically. I'm like, light bulb. Okay, Planet 12. Let's make it make sense. And then L is the 12th letter in the alphabet.
So for the listeners that's listening, y'all just got school. Y'all just heard. Go ahead and repeat that theory. Repeat that scientific theory one more time.
Okay.
12 notes of music, baby.
There's 12 notes of music. 12 is my favorite number. And if you separate them, it's microphone check 1, 2. That's usually what rappers do before they get on the microphone.
Absolutely.
So that concept. And then, you know, as everybody knows, my name is L-A-W, real name being Lawrence. L is the 12th letter in the alphabet. So it all made sense to me. And then being universal, because music is a universal language. And Planet 12 is universal, because I go from jazz to rock to funk to country, you know, to pop music, to EDM. I was in the studio the other night, and I was pulling up some of my tracks, and the engineer was just like jumping up and down, going crazy, like, damn, you do EDM music too? And he's like, wow, this is pretty authentic. I'm like, it better be. I mean, EDM ain't nothing but house music and disco music anyway. Thank you. That's because we know the history. A lot of people don't understand that this shit has been here before. So it doesn't really impress me. Like, when I tell people about Get Lucky, I said, Get Lucky could have easily been a Chic song. Why? Because as soon as you hear that record, you hear who? Now Rodgers playing that rhythm. I'm like, this could have easily been in 79, 78. So Daft Punk is smart. They knew, let's say, if we're going to make this kind of record, we need to call the OG to play some of those minor 7 funk chords on top of this shit. So even though it's the number one pop record to me and you, it ain't nothing but old school disco funk. So you got to know the history. That's the whole bottom line, you know, for me.
Just now Rodgers itself.
Yeah, he's in my top 10 as far as rhythm guitar.
As far as rhythm guitar. So let's fast forward a little bit. Mm-hmm. You had a pretty interesting stint relationship with Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, beyond interesting.
And Amy, you know, Amy Winehouse was one of those things, and it's unfortunate that I really didn't catch on to her whole vibe until after she passed. It's not that I wasn't into it, but I really didn't catch. I didn't really realize how much of an influence that she really was in such of a short period of time. What was your relationship like? What was your contributions working with Amy?
Well, it was very much a big brother little sister relationship, but by all means, because remember she was just 24 at the time.
It was like 24, yeah.
24 when I joined on. And my contributions, because you got to remember, when I came in the singer, because people forget sometimes, you know, Back to Black was such a huge album that people, you know, not the diehard fans, people forgot that she had an album out before that called Friend. That's actually my favorite Amy Winehouse album. And that's actually the record off that song, which is Fuck Me Pumps, that song is what got me to sing backup, because it was offered to me. Because at that point in my career, as you know, even though all these different things were happening for me, I had gotten to a point in my career where I decided who I wanted to sing backup for. Like, everybody was jumping to get money, and I was already making a lot of great money with my corporate gigs and stuff. So honestly, I mean, some people may look at it as arrogance or conceit. It's neither. It's just more so like I'm picky. I'm like, because if I sing backup, my name's going to be attached to that forever, no matter what. So when I have a resume and people read off the names, I don't want to have no name associated with somebody who ain't really hitting for nothing. And it's like not so much with record sales, but just more so about artistry and the things that I believed in fundamentally as an artist and a musician. So I first heard Effie Pumps, it was just like, where do I sign? Because they offered me the job. I didn't know who Amy was. And it was bad on my part, because I'm usually up on everything. So I'm like, no, I never heard of her. So when I went to go through my research, I called them back within 5 minutes. I'm like, I will gladly take the job. So when I came in, I basically was replacing, shout out to my boy Zalan, like that's my dude right there, because you know he's original background Amy singer, and him and his brother is Hashima, who's another badass as well. But Hashima is a soap opera star in London. So he couldn't do the main tour that was about to happen. So that's why Amy's manager came and got me because they heard about me through word of mouth. They heard about the George Clinton thing, and then they saw some clips of me doing shows with some of the members of the Dap Kings. Sharon Jones, rest in peace. Sharon Jones, the Dap Kings, those are my guys. Like, Binky and all those guys, those are my boys. And I did a gig with Neil Sugarman, the leader. This was for a corporate gig, because their lead singer had bailed out on them one night, and they got me at the last minute. And I'm like, I would gladly say, Lord, you know these songs? I'm like, oh, Isley Brothers, I know all this stuff. He's like, and Lord, don't even have to rehearse. I'm like, because I lived it. This is songs that I've been singing since I was a kid. Work to Do, I Got That Feeling by James Brown. And you're going to get the splits too. So it's like, that whole reputation for me was already word of mouth. I didn't have to audition because they already knew. They heard about me already. It was like, yo, we got to get this law guy. Like, he's a... And when me and Amy met, it was interesting because Amy comes in, you know, she's happy about it. He's like, yeah, I've been hitting, you know, she met. So we did a one check rehearsal. She left. We did David Letterman. And then we started to bond over that time when we did the MTV Movie Awards. Because keep in mind, I was only slated to do David Letterman. You know, I'm just happy-go-lucky. I'm just happy.
You're just happy to be there. Right.
I'm happy to be there. And like, right. I'm excited, you know, saw Chris Rock. Because in case you didn't know, Chris Rock's famous uncle is Ray Rock from Crown Heights Affair. That's his uncle that played drums. So when I saw Chris, I had never knew that. For years, my mother had told me, like, you know, that's Chris, you know, that, you know, that's Ray Rock's nephew. And I'm like, oh, really? So when I saw him, I was like, yo, Chris, I said, yo, Ray Rock is your uncle? He said, oh, yeah, absolutely, man. That's my big uncle. So the crazy thing about that was that I was in a great place at that point. And then I got another call. They liked what I did so much. Amy's like, yo, Amy was really, really happy with you. She wants to know if you can do that. And so when I came to California, now, as I told you earlier, that's my second hometown. So I'm arriving at the hotel. I'm happy. I'm like, okay, I'm back in LA. It's been a long time, man. So I'm about to drop off my stuff, go to Venice Beach, see if the old neighborhood is still around. And I run into Amy. So Amy's about to have lunch. She's like, no, come sit with us for a second. I know you have to go someplace. You know, that's, she's very homey like that. She loved being around people. And we sat there and she looked at me and she says, Sam Blues Man Taylor, huh? And I'm like, you know my grandfather? Because you got to remember, you have to really be a deep blues doo-wop head to know who my grandfather is.
She was very eclectic like that.
She's eclectic and did her homework. And here's the thing, I put her to the test. Because you know in her song, she says, you can't teach me nothing I didn't learn from Mr. Hathaway. And of course, she's referencing the great Donny Hathaway. Shout out to my big sister, Layla. Me and Layla are close. That's my homegirl for life. And,
shout out to Layla.
Yeah, oh God, that's a whole nother conversation. Love that woman. But so Donnie, you know, of course, being an influence on me, and I'm like, well, she mentioned Donnie, but I want to see if she, because anybody, a lot of singers mentioned Donnie, but for guys like us, it's like, how deep of a Donnie fan are you? Don't say a song for you, because anybody can say that. Everybody knows that's a signature, you know, shutdown song. I said, what's your favorite Donnie album? And that's how I usually get people. I used to test people. What's your Donnie album? She said, you know, I love the first album, but I have to say, Extension of a Man. I said, that's my favorite. We're done. After that, me and her became, that conversation lasted for 2 hours over some great lunch. This is fresh off of a flight from New York. So to sum it all up, our relationship was very much brother and sister. We've always had laughs and stuff. And in that short period of time that I worked with her, you know, it just, my contributions to it all is pretty much the excitement level that Luther Vandross background singers have. Because up until that particular point, you didn't really see, with the exception of Luther Vandross, like, you know, Lisa Fisher and Cindy Meisel and his unit, hadn't seen background singers. You know, you haven't seen background singers that were brought to the forefront like that. Like, Amy let us be seen. And it wasn't like I was asking to be seen. I'm just doing my job. But she loved the choreography that we did, and we created so much that it became renowned. So I would say we definitely brought the soul aspect and the performance aspect, because Amy's not going to dance. So Amy's going to be pretty much like Gladys Knight and just, you know, do her little ditty bop and sing. And me and Z, we the Pips. We killing steps, and we all right. And the Pips my idol too. So, you know.
So I think Patty and Gladys got a versus coming up here pretty soon.
Yes, they do. And I will be in attendance, man. That's going to be awesome. Everybody asks me a stupid question. Who do I got? Are you stupid? I got both of them.
I got both of them. Yeah. No. I got both of them.
And keep in mind, they were never rivals. They're friends. So.
Yeah. You know, we could edit this. We could edit this part out.
No, you got to edit it. I'm real, man. I don't care.
You know, the funny thing is, I kind of feel that they're both great singers. There's no words to describe. What do you think, just as far as though, as far as era, do you think they really belong? You know, I get the Versus thing, and I appreciate it. Shout out to Swiss for putting that together.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I was thinking, though, know, like, man, does those two really belong together? Because even though that they're relevant, they're kind of in different times. Now, I can see like a Gladys Knight and Diana Ross. I can see a Gladys Knight and Diana Ross. I can see a Patti LaBelle, maybe a Stephanie Mills. But those two, Patti and Gladys, what do you think about the combination?
Well,
you think that's a good combination?
No, it's an excellent combination. I'm going to tell you why I respectfully disagree with you.
Okay.
You got to remember, they both started at the same time. The only difference is that Gladys was able to hit a little bit earlier than Patti did. Because remember, Patti LaBelle. Patti LaBelle and the, no, even before LaBelle, Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, before they became LaBelle. Yeah, remember, the Bluebells was Patti, of course, my mentor, Nona Hendrix, Sarah Dash, and Cindy Birdsong, who later joined the Supremes. So you got to remember, when Cindy Birdsong left, that's how they became LaBelle, but they were still stuck in that whole late 60s thing where they were still doing the long dresses. And it wasn't until they got with that girl, Vicky, that's how they revamped their whole image, because except the times were changing, and if you didn't keep up with the times and how things were kind of moving with the psychedelic look and the whole thing,
right.
You're going to lose. So Patti was smart, but at that particular time, Gladys already had a lane that nobody really else had. Forget the fact that she was inside the motor. Gladys and Pips had a lane that nobody kind of really had, because of her voice and because of the Pips being who they were, because even their background arrangements were different than most other groups that sung in that caliber. So they very much belong as a matchup together, because you gotta remember, they both left their prospective situations and both had equal solo success. Not only that, but also in the 80s, they were part of what I call the Black Pop movement, which means that all of the singers who were popular more so in my mom's day, now in the 80s, here they were. Here's Patti LaBelle with New Attitude and Stir It Up, and here's Gladys Knight with Save the Overtime for Me and Love Overboard. They were getting
bangers. They reinvented themselves. They definitely reinvented themselves.
So this think about this verse. It's 20 songs apiece. You don't think in that whole preface, first of all, it's going to overrun, because you got to remember, they got more than just 20 hits. This is Patti and Gladys we're talking about.
Right.
They have more than just 20 hits. Gladys by herself, and then the other half with the Pips, which gives her, if this is a competition, it gives Gladys the slight edge. But because remember, Patti LaBelle, she had some hits with LaBelle, but the majority of Patti's hits is really her solo stuff, the majority. Whereas with Gladys, it's even. Gladys had a lot of hits with the Pips, but she had a lot of hits with herself too. So
now we know that they got the hits. Okay. Now listen. I'm being respectful though.
Okay, yeah.
All right. Respectfully, now Gladys is my lady. Patti though, the vocals.
Well, we're talking about vocals. That's just
if we're talking about vocals, the Patti is I would have to give Patti the edge. I have to give Patti the edge, and that's what I'm saying as far as competition is concerned. Stephanie Mills would have been, as far as if we were going by vocals and how they sing, uh-huh. Stephanie Mills probably would have matched up a little bit better.
Well, let me put it to you in another way, and I've always said this is something I had to learn even growing up, you know, as a singer and a vocal coach myself. You know, I say this all the time. Who's the better singer in any situation is always subjective, because people gonna like who they like for various reasons. Some people, man, you gotta remember, it's subjective meaning that, because you gotta remember, think about it. You got your favorites, I got my favorites. So even if it's not my favorite, if I'm looking at it from a perspective standpoint, I'm going to always sit there and judge it upon, okay, if I had 3 hours in a day, or even 2 hours for a day, who would I listen to in that amount of time? Even if I get tired of them, who am I going to listen to in that amount of time? To be honest with you, this is to be all the way real. I love both of those ladies, but you know they're not. You know they're all in my top. As far as like the Divas are concerned, they're my top five and top six.
Absolutely, but absolutely.
My number one favorite female singer of all time, who I can listen to pretty much for three, and I've done it for 3 hours straight, is Chaka Khan. Simply because with Chaka, it was a whole nother level with Chaka, because Chaka had the jazz and R&B, but you never knew what Chaka was going to do. You think you got to figure it out, and then from the Rufus stuff to her solo stuff. So that's just sidebar. But again, it's subjective, because some people may say, well, you know, I prefer Aretha all day, who's number two for me. But the thing is that everybody, it's all subjective. Everybody has what they like tones and phrasing. Some people don't like, I can't stand the way Beyonce's singing. I love Beyonce's voice. Some people don't. That's okay. It's okay to be subjective. Now, to say she can't sing, you're being stupid, because she's trained.
Just being real dumb.
But the thing
right,
is that,
right.
Yeah, it's just, you sound stupid. She can't sing. I said, no, it's not that. You probably don't like her tone. One of my favorite singers, and people used to look at me like I was crazy, because I worked with her twice, Rihanna. I worked with Rihanna twice and on overseas doing shows and stuff like that. You know why I love Rihanna? Because Rihanna has a, what I call, in my personal opinion, and this is just my opinion, and I'm a producer and a singer, this is why I have a right to my opinion in terms of that. The more distinct your voice is, the more you have longevity, because guess what? We're gonna always affiliate you with that voice. What I tell singers all the time when I'm working with them is, you have to own what your voice is. If your voice is somewhat thin, work that shit to, as George Clinton would say, work that sucker to death. Work it to the point where you can do your riffs and your runs and all that, in that thin voice that you have, work what you have. That's the magic of somebody's voice. If your voice is not heavy like Martha Wash, Martha Wash is Martha Wash. Nobody can sing like Martha Wash. Same thing with Aretha. You can do Aretha runs, but my thing is that as much, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I guess it's a crazy subject, but as all of us singers, we all, it's like a pot of gumbo. I have right. So many favorite singers who I cop a lot of my styles from Buddy Miles to Jermaine Jackson to Lionel to George Michael to Larry Dawson of the Barcades. I borrowed from all of them one way or the other, besides Prince and Stevie and Luther and all those guys. I borrowed little bits and pieces because I knew my voice at 15. When I learned what my voice was and what I can do, what my range was, it made me comfortable within myself. I didn't have to fight trying to sound like somebody else. And eventually, people will hear my influences when I sing certain things, but they also be like, Law sounds like Law. And that's what singers don't realize. So to piggyback, you know, not to be long-winded, to go back to what you said earlier, it's subjective. So it depends on if you favor more Patti LaBelle, that's just what it is. Everybody has the right to have their favorite. I don't knock anybody for saying, well, I think she has the edge. I just want to know your reason, but you gave your reason. It makes sense.
I do like the distinctive voices. Casey, yeah. You know, the Casey Haley's.
There you go.
Michael McDonald's.
Oh God! If you don't like Michael McDonald, I can't trust you.
Right.
James Ingram.
James Ingram.
The late James. I had a chance. I worked with him some years. The late James Ingram, one of the only few guys who influenced me that took time to kick it with me. We kicked it for like 3 hours, man, backstage, just hanging out.
Man, Joe, man. Rest God, in heaven, Mr. Ingram.
God bless him. I get emotional when I talk, you know.
So going back a little bit here, and that was an interesting sidebar conversation. Thank you, brother.
It was. I'm glad we had it.
All right. So let's get into your album here.
Okay.
What was the inspiration for that album? And I have some lyrics that I heard that I'm a quote from you. What I really liked about the official New York City gritty
music. One of my favorites, gritty music. Oh wow.
That was a lesson, brother. That was a lesson.
Yeah.
That was really a lesson. Yeah, it was a lesson. You know, there you have a verse in there. A lyric says, you can learn a lot from a dummy, so buckle up your so better buckle
metaphor.
Up.
Metaphor.
No, absolutely. But that's what I'm saying. It was a lesson, because there was a lot of hidden gems, a lot of subliminals and everything. You know, the punchlines was hidden.
Oh wow, thank you.
Metaphorically, metaphorically, you have to think out of the box of what you're really talking about. But let's touch on that song, man. Why is that song? What was the inspiration for that song? That is one of my. It was a banger, bro. It was a banger.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Truth be told, and by the way, that's actually a crowd favorite as well. We do a whole jazz thing on top of all that sometimes. We fuck with it a lot on stage. So shout out to my band, the Plants Over Movement. I love these guys. But the inspiration behind that song, truth be told, was I had already recorded like the majority of the record. And the one thing I've always done with any project that I do, of course, you know, it only being two albums, because the second album is a live album, but the whole thing was to make sure I captured both sides of my hip hop pedigree. So for every commercial joint, like, you know, Walk the Train Car was a pretty commercial hip hop record, but you know, my flow was still present no matter what, but it was a fun song for people to dance to. That's a popular one for us too. But I wanted to make sure I had that underground lyricism part of who I am, because that's the world I come from. I come from the world of battling. I come from the world of MCing. So my thing was to make sure that for every two commercial rap joints I had on the record, I had two lyrical bangers. So of course, that was like straight underground. The beats were more raw, was more grimy, but it still had that appeal. And of course, I'm gonna always put the singing aspect, because I'm gonna make sure there's a balance. And you know, being a singer, it gives me the freedom to create my own hooks. I don't have to hire nobody to sing a hook. So for me, it's like, I get creative with this. So for me, having the lyricist part of that was making sure the rhymes were potent, and you got it. So that's why it's called Official New York City Gritty Music. And that whole singing the background parts, that's just the doo-wop street corner thing that I've always, you know, that's part of my lineage because of my granddad and whatnot. But that's really what it was. It wasn't about anything, no deeper meaning. I just wanted to pay homage to remind people that, you know, no matter how commercial this thing gets, no matter who I've worked with, I'm still that same Brooklyn hood boy from St. Mark's Avenue, Albany Project. So I always made sure that the lyricism was in place, and homage to G-Rap and Kane and, and Helter Skelter and all the guys who influenced me. I want to make sure that whenever I go to mic and spit a verse, you're going to know I'm going to spit something. I'm never going to fall off. I'm never going to fall behind as an MC, no matter how much singing and dancing and musicianship I do. So that part... But that was on.
So this is Hip-Hopalypse, and about hip hop. So you've been on big stages, man, and and I'm gonna be honest with you, brother. I really feel that this, I could talk to you for three days, and I don't think we'll touch the surface. And just as a journalist and as a DJ, I'm gonna be straight front and honest with you. I really feel that this interview, because you've done so much, and I'm gonna try to wrap it up and tie it up for the listeners, I think it's incomplete because of everything that you've done. But I do have to ask this question.
Sure.
With you being on stage with heavy hitters, you know, and really, really quick, I just want to just go down the list of some of the people that you've been on stage. So we know Amy Winehouse now, Rick James, Alicia Keys, Neo, Lionel Richie, Big Daddy Kane, Rakim. Let me say it again, Rakim. Morris Day and the Time, and I want to mention that again, Morris Day and the Time.
Of course.
Bruno Mars, Tyrese, Michelle Williams, Leon Silvers from the Silvers?
Yeah. Great. The great, yes. The great.
From the Silvers.
His younger brother Foster calls him Yoga. Yoda. Yep. Jeez. AKA Yoda.
And so ladies and gentlemen, there was a lot of other artists that was not mentioned because it would take a long time. And for the sake of time, that's no disrespect to them, and they're not least, but it's a lot of them. So you've been on grand stages, you work with grand people. And so you also said that you're from a battle rap culture as well.
Absolutely.
All artists, lyrical, people lesson. What? So the long story short, what do you think about this whole battle, this reinvigorated battle rap culture that is back?
You talking about like Smack DVD and all that kind of stuff?
Smack, Loaded Lux, love it. Arsenal. I interviewed my man Moneybags. Good.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's my dude right there.
Yeah, I like interviewed Moneybags. Moneybags is my guy, man. He's my guy.
I love this current rap battle culture that we have, because you got to understand something. I'm from the era where you couldn't just say you were the best and that was that. You had to show and prove. And because I came up in an arena where I didn't lose rap battles, my whole thing was just, you know, how fast can you think on your feet? How can you deconstruct the opponent in front of you? How leverages your game to where you can have your rhymes already set? Because people don't realize that it, as much time as it takes to construct the rhyme, it takes more time to even remember it. Some people are very good in terms of just coming up with stuff on the spot. I'm one of those guys. Like, I'm so into what I'm doing. You gotta remember, I'm from the era of ranking. I'm from the era of playing the dozens where, you know, I knew how to rank on people as a kid. So for me, it was like the balance of having that, but then putting the rhyme form when it made sense. So me seeing it the last 10 years, you know, actually my boy,
Hey Law, hold on real quick. So ranking is an East Coast thing. Out here in the West Coast, y'all, we used to say we use a bag or cap on people, snapping on.
Oh, okay. Wow. We say snapping, we say ranking, we say dissing. Like it could be either form, but the whole thing was that, you know, seeing all those guys like Mav Hoffa and Loaded Lux and all, I love all of these guys. I said, and they're all different. I'm like, who's like that? I'm like, I just want to see who's going to outdo who at that particular point, because again, it sharpens your skills. If you call yourself an MC, you have to do it. That's why I said I was proven. Like I said, I went through the battle test. I was every battle I had, I won. So for me, it was like I put myself through the test to prove myself. I wasn't going around saying my moniker, the most talented kid in the music biz, my DJ came up with that. I didn't even come up with that. So my thing as far as proving who I was on all around talent, but especially when it came to the rap part of it, because I realized, I'm like, if I don't win these battles, how am I going to prove to anybody that I'm a dope MC? So through high school and through all that, and after a while, people didn't test me no more. That's how you know when you're official, when they don't want to test you and they're not going to come at you crazy way, because they respected my battle pedigree by the time I graduated high school. And I was one of the MCs that know. I mean, they tell me this all the time now when I put up posts from high school. They'd be like, oh, I was one of the top five, if not number, like the top two. Like, that was one of the MCs to beat. That's a good feeling because they remember that. They remember how serious it was. And they see me now, they'd be like, he's still nice. Like, the fact that he still can rhyme like that and come up with these potent rhymes, it's a blessing, man. So absolutely. I love the battle rap.
Shout out to you. And you know what? I had an interview with Cassidy probably about a month ago, man.
Ooh, top 10.
I had an interview with Cassidy. Disaster is one of my all-time favorite.
I like Disaster.
Battle rappers. Disaster, Arsenal, quite for sure. Loaded Lux, Charlie Clifford.
That was a tough battle right there. Disaster and Cassidy, that was crazy.
It was.
That battle?
It was.
Keep in mind, Disaster proved what LL has said about Cannabis all along. And Cannabis is in my top 10 too, but not more than LL is. And I knew LL, to me, LL won that battle, in my opinion. But the thing is that Disaster proved what LL has said. Like, he says, you just sit there and read the internet all day and get these big ass words and put them in the rhymes. So when Cannabis pulled out his book, I was like, it's over. I'm like, you don't plan no rap battle. That's a street rule. That ain't even a rap battle. That's a street rule.
Don't plan no damn book. Yeah, that's.
He blew it. Disaster killed the man. And then going against Cassidy, I'm like, let's see. And Cassidy, that proved that he's one of the best, because he literally, it was pretty close, but I gave the edge to Cassidy. I'm like, he was able to do what a lot of dudes couldn't do with Disaster. Like, I watched about three times, bro, on who edged out who in terms of the delivery, in terms of what bars were being said. I don't go off of ooh. I go off of what I'm hearing.
Right.
You know, fuck a ooh. I'm not into the whole ooh. Anybody can get all tipsy by a line, because some lines go over people's head and they don't hear. I'm like,
right.
Like, well, whatever.
Right.
You know, people.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, you know, as an artist and as a true MC, you always got to keep bars on you. You always got to keep bars on you. It's almost like being
all time.
It's always like
all, being all day.
You always got to have your piece on you, man. But So I always ask this question before I let them go to all of the artists, man. We really, so check it out. You have an impressive resume.
Thank you again. Appreciate that.
I am going to make sure, man, to post everything about you, my man. It's been a real honor to speak and learn
about you.
We're gonna have to get back together, man, and do a part two, because I really want to zone in on this whole hip hop culture a little bit more, like we did, brother. But
anytime, man. Let me know.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, amazing interview with Law. This man here is a musical genius.
Thank you.
You guys just got done listening to our interview where we touched on so many things in a small amount of time. And to be quite honest with you, y'all know that the listeners that's going to be listening to this, y'all know that we could have went on all the way to next week, to be quite honest with you.
You slot talking about
genius. That's what's up. But before the show, man, are you two questions? The first question that I have is, are you happy where you are musically, artistically right now? And what would you today, what would the Law today go back and tell the Law when he was 16, when he was 13 years old? What would you tell that 13-year-old Law?
Okay, that's a two-parter. So the first question, I am very happy of where I am. You know, the thing for me is that I'm never complacent. I've never had it. So for me, with the amount of success that I was able to attain, you know, I'm always in a growth spurt. There's only I'm forever growing. I'm forever evolving because you never stop learning. You never stop getting better at what you do. Craftsmanship is very important. In the words of Shirley Lee Ralph, stay ready so you never have to get ready. And my philosophy has always been the next best thing is always around the corner. Because actually in the last, I'm going to say probably 7 to 8 years has been the most successful in comparison to the years when I was starting out and making my way through the industry. So these last 6 or 7 years have been a blessing to me, thanks to you know, my incredible fans, and then just the fact that, you know, my name is starting to ring more bells. And so even people that just learning the history, or they know about it and they're learning more about what I've done, it's always a blessing in itself. I'll never put myself on this level where I think like, okay, you should know certain things about me. It's like, no, because some people don't know. And in the age that we live in, you know, in terms of social media and making sure that your online presence is just as important as what your craftsmanship is, it leaves the door open to just continue to grow as a thing. So of course, I want more like anybody else. You know, you want to do more, but in the meantime, where I'm at, I'm very happy. I have no qualms about it, especially because I'm an independent artist. I own my own masters. I'm good with all that. So a lot of people can't say that, not even major artists.
Right.
So it's a good feeling. The second part of that question, what would my age tell the 16-year-old or 13-year-old, whatever, in that same stage? Honestly, Lord, you a bad motherfucker. You good.
Right.
Simply because of the fact that I didn't have to find me. Everybody knows I'm not always at a loss for words. And then I just, because, you know, a lot of times people tried to make me feel guilty because of me being confident in what I was doing. Of course, humble at all the times, but I feel like the humble part of it is left when you get off stage. When people meet you in person, they get to see who the man is behind the mask, you know, the whole humility thing, and, you know, saying thank you and appreciating people. But when I'm on stage, I'm a madman. That's why, you know, that's why my DJ named me the most talented kid in the music biz, because the stage is my playground. So when I'm on stage, I'm like a 12-year-old kid when I act out. You got 10 minutes. Damn, that's it. I'm about to have a tantrum. So in these 10 minutes, I got to get off the stage. But these last 10 minutes, we going to throw down. Y'all going to remember this show. That's always been my whole thing, because you only got that time. Whatever time that's given to you, you got to maximize. You know, ain't no time to be sitting down wasting. That's why this COVID thing is so crazy, because if you didn't, during this whole quarantine season, if you didn't become better at who you are and what you did instead of complaining, then it's all your fault. You can't blame COVID and none of that for that. So
Hip-Hopcalypse would not have existed, come into existence, if it wasn't for COVID. I started Hip-Hopcalypse April 5th.
Mm-hmm.
I got laid off from my job, my 9-to-5 job, April 3rd.
Wow.
My job April 3rd, and I was sitting around saying, you know what, I can't DJ anymore, because I'm a DJ also. I can't go to my clubs, I can't go to the bars, I can't do my weddings, I can't do anything right now. I lost my 9-to-5 job. I need something to keep me sane. And Hip-Hopcalypse was started, and you know what, I tell you, it was something from God that said, and I'm gonna take a bone from Busy Bone, who I interviewed.
I love Busy Bone. Oh my God.
He said, God said, if you don't do it now, you're not gonna do it. And
True.
So I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but it's a testimony.
No,
of just
it's a testimony.
It's a testimony. You have to make some things work for you. So, ladies and gentlemen, Law, it's been a pleasure. Y'all need to make sure that y'all go look at the Law documentary on YouTube. You guys need to make sure that you listen to his various projects, and I'm gonna give you the opportunity, Law, to let people know where you are, but you guys need to make sure that you guys listen to his stuff on YouTube. Very intriguing. Make sure that you guys listen to that official also found on YouTube. That New York City grimy music, man, that is tight. Law, let the people know where they can find you, my man.
Of course, Twitter and Instagram is at Planet 12 Law. Facebook.com/LawPlanet12. And funny thing, you brought up YouTube, because tomorrow we're going to unleash the revamping of my YouTube page. So basically, that's Law Planet 12.
So on YouTube, Law Planet 12, y'all. Law Absolutely. Planet 12. And so, Law, brother, thank you so much for being on the show, my man.
Thank you for having me,
bless
man.
You. Appreciate it. Bless you, my man. Bless you, my man. And ladies and gentlemen, Law was on Hip-Hopocalypse. Brother, bless you.
You already know. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.